and welcome to a lock-in at the Crate and Crowbar. This week, we're taking a look at the recently released seasons of two anthology crime shows featuring troubled cops and yet more troubling crimes, namely the fifth season of Fargo and the fourth of True Detective. I'm Marsh Davis, the unheimlich whisper of the occult that may or may not haunt these proceedings, and to help ground this commentary in something like the human plane, I'm joined by the hard-bitten, hard-drinking, hard man of words, the TV and video games writer, Jamie Britton.
Oh, you betcha.
That is a creditable attempt at the accent, I have to say.
Thanks.
Where it's from, who knows, but it's a creditable attempt. In fact, we should start by taking a quick look back at where these two shows have come from, because they both have slightly strange inceptions. Fargo started as a film, obviously, by the Coen brothers before being adapted into an anthology series of fairly unrelated crimes, but connected by Noah Hawley, who's the showrunner on it. So what's your history with it? Were you a big fan of the original film, and what did you make of the earlier seasons of Fargo?
Every time I watch the original Fargo movie, I kind of feel a bit annoyed. I get kind of annoyed at how good it is and how it sort of feels like the best movie released in the 90s. It's just an amazingly brilliant movie. It's a crime caper. It's kind of got these comedic elements, these kind of surreal elements. But it's also this kind of metaphysical puzzle. It doesn't reveal its sort of themes or meaning easily. You know, it's about ordinary people and the kind of, you know, the sort of joys and sorrows of ordinariness as a concept. But it also seems to kind of take place in a kind of realm of ideas above its station as a crime movie. It just doesn't feel like anything else. I love it kind of top to bottom. And I think, you know, particularly Frances McDormand's performance in there is just such this crucial bit of work she does, which I think is, you know, that kind of grounding presence of a decent human being is something that you'll see, you know, through all of these iterations of the TV show. But yeah, I absolutely love the movie. I think it's one of the best sort of 1-2 punches that directors have ever made, with, you know, making that and then The Big Lebowski straight afterwards, which are these, like, kind of, not really, but I always think of them as sort of mirror images of each other. In that Fargo is, they're not even, there's no real case you can make for that, except for the fact that, like, Fargo is about, you know, the way that violence can kind of, like a kind of disease, sort of start to kind of corrupt ordinary life and how it spreads and blossoms. And The Big Lebowski is about kind of, I don't know, about how stupid everything is and about how the dude sort of stumbles into this, you know, this sort of crime story and makes no measurable effect on it whatsoever before leaving sort of worse off than he was at the beginning. You know, there's something in the, again, in the sort of existential realm there that feels of a piece with each other. And then the Fargo TV show. So when this first came out, I remember watching the first few minutes of the first episode, which featured Carter Burwell's amazing, you know, majestic score for the movie. And I have to admit, I turned it off in disgust. Because I was thinking, like, what is this? I didn't really understand what the concept was. I was like, oh, they're just using the music from the movie. Like, it's theirs. Like, you know, just sort of stolen valor. And I switched it off in disgust. When I eventually came back around to watch that first series, I realized that they use that music cue, I think, twice in the whole show. They use it in the opening scene and in the closing scene of that season. And I don't think they ever use it again. They use it about once or twice every season, basically. And, you know, they sort of, when you realize that, you realize how carefully they tread on the tropes that they steal from the Coen brothers' sort of oeuvre. But yeah, the TV show, which basically uses the themes of Fargo, and as the show kind of goes on, using the themes of kind of everything and anything from Coen brothers' movies and characters and aspects and ideas, and kind of taking new spins on them. And it's pretty much my favorite TV show of the last decade or so. The thing I adore about it is I think that Noah Hawley is a kind of quite a traditional TV writer in a funny kind of way. you know, he deals in characters and dialogue and kind of the ambition that I think often characterizes his work is always in tension with a really kind of concentration on characters and on the dynamics in scenes and on a kind of dynamic way of telling a story. And I just find him at his best completely just without without peer in American television, really. It's, you know, when a series of Fargo is up and running and at speed and at its best, I just think there's absolutely nothing like it at all.
That's definitely true. Like, I don't think there is another project quite like it, which is as discursive about another set of filmmakers' oeuvre. You know, in the way that Fargo returns to iconography and themes within the Coen Brothers movies and restitches them and plays with them through all five seasons of it, reiterating and reconstructing these ideas that you see from elsewhere. And I can't think of another example of something which is as studious as this series is of the Coen Brothers' work. It's almost like it's a set of film studies, but rewritten as narratives themselves.
Yeah, I just love that about it. I mean, you could definitely do it for another stylized director, or you could do it for Quentin Tarantino, or you could do it for Wes Anderson. You know, there's all sorts of people who have
God
this.
God forbid.
And, you know, I suppose Stranger Things is kind of a version of that with, or at least started off as a version of that for Steven Spielberg. But it does seem like a kind of crazily impossible thing to pull off, especially how quickly he goes off in his own direction, even in that first series. Mm. You know, it tells the story of Fargo, but it also tells about five other stories on top of that, and kind of then ranges off in all sorts of crazy directions. That first series, which has Billy Bob Thornton as Lorne Malvo, who is kind of more like a version of Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men, this kind of primeval nightmare figure that returns again and again in the show. And I think he might be my favorite. There's a moment kind of relatively far into that show, and we should probably say we're going to spoil things, aren't we? So we can...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, full spoilers. There's a moment quite far into that show where Martin Freeman has managed to kind of escape his terrible fate after dealing with this guy, and has kind of become rich and powerful out of it, out of the deal with the devil he made with him. And he's in Vegas being given the Insurance Salesman of the Year award, and he spots Billy Bob Thornton looking completely different, with like kind of stylish hair and with a beautiful woman on his arm, kind of laughing at a table. And it's just this kind of amazing moment where everything gets turned on its head. You know, you can't understand what he's doing there, why he's so different. And it's just like, it's TV at its absolute best, I think. It's TV kind of performing magic tricks, really, where things just seem so impossibly crazy and dramatic. And I think Hawley definitely kind of trades in those moments better than pretty much anyone.
Yeah, there's a mischievous manipulation of reality bordering on the supernatural and sometimes crossing straight into the supernatural within Fargo, which is very surprising whenever it emerges, because it is otherwise quite a straight down the line, if kind of like broad and comic in certain ways, but it's otherwise, you know, rooted in the human world. And then there's these alarming moments of unreality to it, which we will compare perhaps with those of True Detective. But it's interesting because I actually also turned off the first season of Fargo, partly because I felt like, oh, is this just a remake of the film, almost straight, you know, a remake of the film, because it begins with using many of the same setups as the film does. And then, you know, it's got Martin Freeman doing the accent that you just did at the beginning of the show, and about as well. But I'd also just watched Happy Valley, which is, again, basically just Fargo, but in the north of England. And that was very, very good. And I didn't feel like I needed a third Fargo to complete the set. But it turns out I did, because I returned to it. And as you say, it diverges and does its own thing. And then the subsequent seasons are also very different. But they all, I mean, what would you say is like the commonality? There's like a common sort of milieu that the crimes emerge in, right?
Yes, it's kind of, I mean, they're all, or at least 80% of them are set in Minnesota, or around that kind of area. Ordinary people caught up in crime, I think, it has always been Noah Hawley's kind of touch point. That's where he kind of starts off. Unkillable primal forces of evil. So Billy Bob Thornton in series one. In series two, they don't really have one, or they kind of mess with that. In series three, they have David Thewlis, and like he makes the whole show. I'm not sure series three would be anything like as good as it is without David Thewlis, who's just an actor I adore anyway. Like Naked is one of those performances that's just completely out there and completely unique. And every time he's in anything, even Harry Potter, I'm just delighted by his presence. Yeah. Including the creepy guy in The Big Lebowski, who's just did it for one scene, giggling at Julianne Moore's house. Yeah, and he's just fantastic. The scene where he's first introduced, where he's just sat in a room at Ewan McGregor's office company, and Ewan McGregor goes in to see him, and the way, the sense of menace that David Thewlis can project just by sitting in a room looking crap in his cheap suit, unbelievable. And that part was very much, I think, conceived in the early days of sort of Trump lumbering towards the White House. And that series in particular ends with an amazing final scene where they've kind of captured him, and the kid, you know, the kind of Marge Gunderson cop style cop has captured him and sat him in a room at an airport. And he's saying to her that because of all his kind of machinations, any moment now, someone's going to come in, knock on the door and send him on his way, because that's what corruption affords you. And she's sort of saying, I don't think that's going to happen because I've got you on tape doing these terrible crimes and stuff like that. And then the series ends. The series ends with the question hanging in the air, like, can these awful people get away with what they do, or will they face charges for this? And it's a wonderful, uncertain ending, which I think is given a kind of an angelic version in the more recent series as well. And then series four, which is a complete mess, was a real disappointment. He kind of tried to do a sort of post-Black Lives Matter story of racial tension in the 1950s in Kansas, and it's just too ambitious. There's so many characters, everyone having to do so much, lots of people making big, long speeches that go nowhere. It's as expansive and overcrowded as you could possibly fear a kind of anthology show to be, and it just ends up collapsing in on itself by the ending and sort of meaning nothing and growing into nothing. I think Noah Hawley at his worst, he will cash loads of checks early on in the series, and then they all end up bouncing by the end, and he's kind of ends up doing a sort of creative version of robbing Peter to pay Paul by the end, in that his characters will often arrive at moments of realization or development which just haven't been sort of fed through from the start. And series, normally he can write around it. He's such a flamboyantly talented, moment to moment, scene to scene writer and director that normally he can just bounce his way through it. I mean, Legion series three is a complete mess and shouldn't work at all, but it manages to be brilliant just because of that fact. But in series four of Fargo, yeah, it really collapses in on itself, despite some good stuff in there. Jesse Buckley playing an angel of death nurse was really, really good. I love her. I think she should be in more things.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so those are the kind of the four series of it, kind of going through it in a slightly weird way. Two things. One thing I love that he does is he'll often start episodes in a completely different place, somewhere you're completely unfamiliar with. You've got no idea what's going on. And then the way he'll find his way from that scene, like two unrelated people in an office you've never seen before, the way he'll find his way from that scene back to the drama that you're sort of going along with is often kind of gleefully violent and just kind of gloriously convoluted. And I just adore that about him. The other thing to say is I recently worked with Martin Freeman. I told him how much I loved Fargo. And he said, I'm glad you liked it because I was fucking freezing the entire time.
Should we talk about True Detective?
Yeah, let's talk about True Dick.
So that came out of seemingly nowhere in 2014. I hadn't really heard of any of the people involved in creating it, probably just my own ignorance, but Nick Pizzolatto seemed to, I don't know what he had done before, but somehow he had come out of the blue and written this incredibly distinctive, tonally shocking piece of Southern noir fiction with occult leanings. It was also structurally very kind of arresting because it uses these this framing narrative, these two separate interrogations of these two incredibly fucked up Louisiana detectives, and it explores their recollections and sometimes fictions across a course of 17 years as they are working to solve a series of crimes with seemingly occult links, and it discusses how their relationship evolves during that time and how their lives ultimately fall apart. And just that structure was so different and expertly executed. I can see why it became this huge thing at the time, even though now looking back on it there, and even at the time, there were things about it which I felt a bit of disquiet about. it's a very masculine show, and it shows these two characters indulging themselves in their worst instincts a lot of the time in ways which sometimes feel like it goes beyond what is necessary for their characters and becomes something more a result of the male gaze with which the entire fiction has been constructed. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think at the time, and I messaged you a screenshot of Facebook reminding me how much I loved it at the time. It's like, yeah. Just today I got a Facebook memory saying, yo, True Detective, yo. So at the time I remember it feeling incredibly refreshing. I think I'd been working as a TV writer for quite a while at that point, and I was pretty jaded by it all. And I think True Detective felt genuinely fresh and interesting. If you remember, it had a title sequence, which everyone sort of immediately identified as one of the best ever. You know, the music, the title sequence, the direction of the show is amazing. You know, it has this incredible unbroken action sequence early on, which just blew my mind when I saw it. I think that might have been what prompted me to write that Facebook message. And yeah, so much to admire in it. Yeah, it felt so unique. The performances, particularly Matthew McConaughey, who was just going through his reconnaissance at that point and was a revelation to me.
Yeah.
Time is a flat circle and all that stuff. Really very good. I remember when I was watching it, I was texting back and forth with my friend Dave, who's always my source of kind of balance on things that which are very, very male and very, very heteronormative. And he was sort of saying to me, don't you think this show hates women a bit? And kind of watching it, I remember feeling, yeah, quite a lot of unease, particularly in the way that kind of sex was portrayed, the way that sort of sexual trauma was then sort of a way of kind of rewarding Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey's character by having these kind of these survivors of sexual trauma who then became like their girlfriends and rang them up and said things like, I was thinking about you fucking me up the ass. And it was just like a lot.
Yeah, I think to some extent it can claim some amount of this. I mean, this is the question of all fiction, right? I mean, it can attempt to claim some amount of indemnity by the fact that its characters are very flawed, and it intentionally plays with your sympathies for them. So in one episode, you'll warm to Woody Harrelson's character, and because he is the foil to Matthew McConaughey's very kind of pretentious detective who's spouting all this sort of nihilistic existential bullshit, and Woody Harrelson's just look at him and say, please stop talking to me. And he seems kind of grounded and a more approachable, affable creature. And then later you see this horrible animal side to him, which is absolutely disgusting. But then to what extent is his use of women that of the characters, and to what extent is the use of women in the show the use of the showrunners? It's a very difficult thing to pick apart. But I mean, I do think that regardless of how you parse that morality or the ethics of the season's production, like, there are some things that are just beautiful about the way that it's edited together, so that particularly when it's using these different time periods, and also the amazing makeup work done to age these characters, but the way it's edited together so that dialogue from an interview in the inverted commas present shifts back and forth, sometimes just using the VO and then you just glimpse something in the past as a kind of visual recollection, which then ironically illuminates or undercuts or is undercut by a recollection of that past that's being narrated. It's incredibly sophisticated in the way it uses these different dialogues and the images that it puts to them, and what it shows and when. And I don't know how much of that was on the page and how much of it is then the work of the director or the executive producer or the editor, but somehow a result of that process is that this incredibly intricate thing was produced, and I really admire it for that. And that's the thing that I would wish was the hallmark of the True Detectives then on, moreover than some of the other things that seem to have become its obsessions. But
I would say that at its very best in series one, you as a viewer have that feeling of almost being funneled into these kind of pressurized environments and pushed out the other side. I know that sounds kind of mad, but the way that the storytelling in that first series builds and releases tension by what it shows you in different eras and what it's holding back from showing you, and how it eventually kind of pushes you into a new present, that's sort of post everything that you've seen so far. I think that squashes and squeezes the viewer in unusual ways and makes the viewing experience quite unique.
I'd be really interested to see the whiteboard in which it charts out the different revelations that recast the things that have already been described in different light. Because there must be at least like four layers of revelation in that happen in a non-chronological order, which then transform what you've already seen into a different thing. Not a lot of that makes it to season two, which is obviously the difficult second album.
Yes. Full disclosure, I found this unwatchable and didn't last more than a couple of episodes.
It is unwatchable. I did watch it all, but with an increasing sense of resentment. It's a lot of it is written as though from the purple prose of Matthew McConaughey's detective in season one, but without the foil of Woody Harrelson's character to say this is bullshit. In other ways, it also, as a crime story, doesn't capture many of the things that were interesting about the first. It dispenses almost entirely with any hint of the occult or the supernatural, which is in the first season, but very much like a persistent background element. It doesn't manifest in any kind of way, but there is this uneasy, sickening feeling that these things are being done for some purpose which is unintelligible to humankind. In season two, none of that seems to be there. It just seems to be corrupt politicians, a sleazy world of money and debauchery, and then Vince Vaughn reading out some of the worst monologues possibly ever committed to paper. Season three is a bit of a resurgence in that it doesn't approach the supernatural in quite the same way as the first season. Instead, it has this theme of things being beyond human understanding. Like, for example, our entire conception of time is a thing that the first season also sort of picks at, but it's the real obsession with the third season, where one of the main characters' Alzheimer's diagnosis fractures essentially his sense of time, and he's then essentially living in these three interleaving time periods, which helps construct this narrative as he then tries to put the pieces of this unsolved missing children's case back together before his mind completely unravels entirely. But it still uses this sense of like humanity being on rooted in a reality that it can only comprehend a part of. And whilst in season one that moves towards the supernatural, in season three it feels more like it's describing like an immutable rule of the universe that we are just not capable of understanding things beyond our linear time.
Yeah, I'd also add that season three of True Detective, although I've only watched a bit of it, has the best old person makeup I've ever seen.
It's very impressive, yeah.
I literally can't think of a better example I've ever encountered. They make him look genuinely old. which I'd compare and contrast with the Midnight Mass, previous lock-in subject, Midnight Mass.
Oh, God.
What is the character you see in that? And he's supposed to be old. You're like, well, she's going to age backwards. Like, yes. Something's going to happen there, because that's clearly a 25-year-old woman.
You're like, oh, I'm very old.
Yeah. Should we talk about the new seasons then? Since we've spent half an hour not talking about the subject of the podcast. So season 5 of Fargo, we meet Dorothy Lyon, played superbly by Juno Temple, who is a seemingly meek Midwestern housewife who gets arrested during a unexpected fracas at the meeting of her local school board. And this event triggers a chain of violent events as her previous husband, who is now an uber libertarian sheriff and militia leader, tries to recapture her. And that story draws in the police, the FBI, and her new family, who are lawless billionaires. I enjoyed this immensely throughout.
Yes, me too. I think it's nice to see a return to kind of basics from Noah Hawley in this series. It's very much him playing to his strengths. It's very, after the previous series, it's much more Coen brothers-y in various ways. I think the kind of too long didn't read on all the unpacking we're going to do of this is, I think it's very much him cashing checks that he can't pay, essentially. I think it's got an amazing protagonist, an amazing baddie. Her journey is super vivid and really well drawn and full of unusual choices and ideas and, you know, relationships that she forms. I think more or less everything else around that fails to go anywhere. I think the show really confidently introduces a whole bunch of characters and storylines, and then they essentially lead nowhere. Or where they lead has a hard limit on how real it feels or how truthful it feels. And I think the show sort of falls at the last hurdle and runs out of road. And you think you're going to have more of a kind of crazy enjambment of all the different elements at play. But ultimately, it's just one person's story with some other people thrown in the mix as well.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. Although I actually think, in fact, were it not for the very last scene, I would completely agree with you. But the very final scene rescued it somewhat for me in an odd way. But we'll get to that later. But let's briefly synopsize the new season of True Detective as well. And then we'll move perhaps into the themes that they share. But the new season of True Detective different showrunner, Issa Lopez, has taken what other people have claimed is a very feminist perspective on the True Detective oeuvre, such as it is. A lot of people are very angry about this new season. I'm not quite sure where the anger comes from.
Is it because they're cunts?
Well, yes, it's definitely true for some of the people who are angry.
Well, some
about
of the people.
It.
That's the think problem. It's like some of these people are cunts. Some of these people are internet grognards. And some people, like my mate Bobby, who hates this show, doesn't like the kind of way that supernatural and realistic elements are balanced.
That is my issue with it as well. Although I have a hard time saying that that's a problem with it as an example of True Detective, because this, as we've already discussed, season 2 was a complete and utter shit show. So really, at what point do you just say this is a show in, you know, which has its own merits and is doing a different thing? And to the extent that it shares some DNA with these earlier shows, I don't know that that really diminishes it, even if it isn't necessarily what I would have done with the True Detective IP. But anyway, it features a story in which the members of an Alaskan research station are found dead in a very alarming and horrific and mysterious circumstance. And this leads a disillusioned local chief of police, played by Jodie Foster, and her former partner, who is now a disgraced state trooper, played by Callie Rice. That brings them back together as the new crime links to an unsolved crime in their past. And all the while, there's this theme of civil unrest growing in the background as the winter night is falling and the spirits of the restless dead begin to clamour for justice in quite an explicit way. But I think before we get to like the theme of the supernatural, we should talk about just how overtly political I think both of the positions of these seasons are, specifically in relation to gender. Fargo features storyline of a battered wife who flees the violence of her husband and the incredibly masculine right-wing militia that he originates from, and True Detective as well, by flipping the gender of the protagonists from being male cops to female cops, is also making some statements about the position of women and justice that they can expect in this cruel, cruel world. There's a lot of incredibly feckless, useless men in both of these two shows.
I enjoyed the speech that one of the characters in Fargo gives, which starts with the words, "I want a wife who," and then it's just a list of the most babyish, needy, you know, old-fashioned, ridiculous, you know, things that this guy just wants from his wife. This is the guy who's just been trying to play golf and become a professional golfer while they go broke. And yeah, his speech is an excellent kind of. It's very often in Fargo and in Coen Brothers movies. Actually, they'll give you a sort of benign mirror version of the truly terrible person, right? So he's this kind of asshole who she's ended up married to, and but wonderfully kind of portraying the feckless men and also the kind of everyday violence committed against women, even if it's just the kind of emotional violence of how terribly they treat them.
And then you've got John Hawkes playing Hank Pryor in True Detective, who is this loser cop who's been looked over for promotion and feels very embittered towards Liz Danvers, who's Jodie Foster's character, for getting the job instead of him. I think they've had a past relationship as well, but now he's in the process of getting ripped off by a mail order bride who he expects to arrive throughout the season, but never does. The way he acts out, as a result of that embitterment, didn't entirely ring true for me, but the pitifulness of the character certainly felt real.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a show that's full of complicated relationships. Like, Jodie Foster's character has complicated relationships with everyone in that show. And I think it's interesting, like, where it finds its purity. You know, it finds its purity in the relationship between women for the most part. But also kind of tests that with what that ends up meaning by the end of the show. It's you know, I think it's I think both shows. I think Fargo is the more thematically thin, but probably the more successful series of television. Ultimately, I think True Detective is kind of much more thematically rich. There's a lot more going on. The characters in it feel more motivated, and the characters in it feel in the grips of something huge, which I think is the main success of the show, actually. I think the thematics of True Detective Series 4, Night Country, are really, really up and running straight away. And I found particularly the first few episodes of it really gripping in kind of being drawn into this really unusual and strange world, which also felt very real.
I don't know that I would entirely agree that Fargo is thin thematically. I think in terms of its use of violence against women, I think it actually is thinner. Even though it deals with it very directly, and there's the main character is a survivor of extreme marital abuse. But I found that was less successful for me because of the use of caricature in the show, the way that it's often glibly cruel, like you say earlier, that Noah Hawley delights in violence. and sometimes that violence is very, very funny. And there's an entire thing here where this extremely unpleasant character, who just happens to be a cancer patient, is abducted, tortured, and then executed. And somehow that's funny because he is such a prick. And he would have to be a total prick for that sequence of events to be rendered in any way amusing. But somehow, taking that kind of glib approach to violence and then trying to juxtapose it with a different kind of violence that suddenly we have to be very somber and serious about, quite rightly, just doesn't quite work for me. I don't think you can execute that same tonal shift within the same sort of fiction. But where I would say Fargo was more successful thematically was in its various unpickings of the kind of the larger political environment in which those toxic views emerge. So has different kinds of different aspects of the right in Fargo. You have, on the one hand, you have John Hamm as the leader of this sort of sovereign citizen movement. He's been elected a sheriff, but essentially he's a sheriff who makes his own laws. He is this trad libertarian, has his own completely specious, self-serving view of Christianity, sort of religious fascism, essentially. And he is going up against and colliding with this other form of fascism, which is this sort of corpo libertarian fascism, which emerges from people who've had Ivy League schooling and now think that they are royalty by virtue of coming into vast amounts of wealth. And those two groups are bedfellows politically in America in a lot of cases. And yet here, I think Fargo is very eloquent at finding the kind of the fault lines between all these different, equally toxic, terrible views and seeing where the friction could emerge there. And I don't think True Detective is quite as articulate in terms of its political analysis. It has this vague eco message, and the mining corporation is evil and it's poisoning people, and that stuff does happen. And there's obviously a strong theme in there where the indigenous people are being brutalized essentially by corporatist invaders who do not care for them. But I don't think the reasons for that circumstance to emerge are not as carefully unpicked as it is in Fargo. You don't what is the reason for evil corporatism? You never, if only we could speak to the mining corporation. You never hear, you never really, I mean, it's part of its theme is that this is a shadowy branch of some global corporation which may or may not have some kind of a larger occult purpose. So it can't be interrogated in a way. But that also means that these circumstances which do exist in the real world are then robbed of the kinds of analysis which Fargo actually does go into.
Yes. Well, I guess what I would suggest is that True Detective Night Country goes in hard with a bunch of themes and then struggles to articulate them adequately enough. And that is its sort of major failing as a show. Mm. Like, it's got a lot of vibes. It's got a lot of feelings. Yes. It's got a lot of sense of stuff, and how they connect to these characters as well. It's not sort of floating thematics. Like, every character has a purpose and a journey to go on in this story based on the environment that they're in and their background and stuff like that. It's just that the show stumbles in its second half to articulate those, where I think Fargo goes in with slightly more modest thematic ideas and then actually manages to articulate them pretty brilliantly for the most part throughout. Yeah,
there's a particularly monologue by this season of Fargo's unkillable evil character, Ole Monk.
A man who has a cord.
Yes, I think he's even more of a knowing caricature of than any of the previous seasons' unkillable forces of evil. He's sort of like this mixture between Chigger and Highlander and Werner Herzog, But he's also made very funny, because as he's saying a lot of these very stark, profound sounding things, the other characters are reacting to him in the way that, you know, incredibly nice Minnesotans would.
Yeah.
But he has this great monologue where he's talking about the sort of the preening self-aggrandizement of the right and the rich in America, where he says, I'm not going to try and do it in the Werner Herzog accent, but he says, everywhere you look, you see kings now. Everything they want, they call their own. And if they cannot have it, they say that they are not free. And I think that is like I was listening, I was thinking, oh gosh, yeah, that's extremely good. And it's very good at puncturing the hypocrisy of these sorts of figures. And not only that, but also making them seem absolutely absurd. So, I mean, obviously you've got John Hamm's Roy Tillman stalking towards some act of terrible violence as a version of Britney Spears' Toxic plays, you know. or there's one of the characters on the corpo fascist side. Obviously, it's an incredibly rich man. He just has this. He's always trying to bring up Rommel in every conversation. And it's very, very funny and doing that. And I think it's more successful at making these figures and their views seem absolutely idiotic than many a recent thing that I've seen.
Yes, Jennifer Jason Leigh's character says to Roy Tillman, you want freedom without responsibility, you want to be a baby, which I think is very good indeed.
She's an asshole as well. I mean, she believes that her wealth should buy her immunity, essentially, from any law, and that the laws themselves and the police are simply there to enforce the protection of wealth as it currently exists. I think she's probably the most troubling character thematically in this, because ultimately she is made an ally of the main character.
Just because it's episode 9 and they need to make her an ally now, and she just becomes one. I had such high hopes for that character, and Jennifer Jason Leigh is just about my favorite actor in the world. I just adore her, so she can do just about anything, and I always think she's brilliant. But I do think this show's slightly... again, as I mentioned, it stumbles as it gets into its final act with what it wants to say with those other characters. But I think, you know, in terms of... It's very... in this year of our Lord 2024, it's very hard to conjure the madness of the modern, you know, split between, you know, populism and everyone else. You know, it's a very mad world we find ourselves in, a very stressful world. And I think, you know, Fargo Series 5, and you know, it really tries to conjure that in various ways. You know, the babyfication of men, you know, the, making themselves into these needy, you know, violent people, and the kind of conflation of that with right-wing politics and debt. It's all heady stuff, and actually the show flits between those things quite elegantly, at least through its first half, in a way that makes it feel very much of now, of the time. And then, like, having this primeval evil character who's, you know, they at one point they do a 300 years ago cut, I think that's what it is, or maybe 500 years ago, which is pretty brilliant. And they also have him say the line, I'm a nihilist, I believe in nothing, which just made me literally cheer watching it, because that's the line from The Big Lebowski, which is followed by in that movie, we believe in nothing, Lebowski, and tomorrow we come back and we cut off your Johnson. But just the repurposing of that line for, you know, for a new world, I thought was absolutely amazing.
Well, I think we should talk about nihilism, but just before we get there, I wanted to pick your brains about how you feel cops are portrayed in these series, because I'm a big fan of detective shows and crime procedurals, but of course over the years I've become more and more jaundiced in my view of how policing actually operates, and in the light of the last few years these shows struggle more and more to gain my sympathy for the people who are usually the protagonists in them. Do you think that these two shows have addressed that in any way? Are they pro-cop shows? Are they more complex than that?
Well, I think cinema and television, this is the most obvious thing ever I'm about to say, have this very complicated relationship with police. I think about something like movies from the 70s like Dirty Harry, right? What those movies say is that if you want to have your peaceful existence, you have to basically deal with the fact that people like Dirty Harry exist. A guy who you would literally cross the street to get away from if you saw him coming towards you. And I think there's that tension between, like, yeah, this guy is morally debased, but you need him to shoot serial killers in the head without sending them for trial if this society is going to work at all, right? So that is one of the, I think, major narratives that you see in American cinema and television. It constantly arises, the idea that we need horrible, violent men to kill people without thinking about it too much in order to maintain the peace. And, you know, and I think that's a story that's repeated over and over again. And it's kind of the story of, like, the American military complex as well. I'm sure you could write a mediocre university essay on the conflation of those two things. And I think, you know, one of the things that they do in Fargo in the original movie is they treat the good police officer as a kind of knight figure, right? The kind of, all you need is one person who is genuinely pure and good, and they can kind of walk through this inferno untouched and kind of purge the violence away. And I think the kind of dance between those kind of different kinds of cop, you know, the one who you know, god damn it, doesn't do things by the book, and the one who's the one good cop left in the station, you know, these are kind of such cliche narratives. I think Fargo does a great job usually of having a mix of those things. In the first series, they have Bob Odenkirk playing her boss, who's just incompetent. He's a nice guy who's incompetent, which I think is a really nice take on that. And they often have interesting versions of the cops like that. Whereas I think True Detective, it goes for that hyper-masculine aspect of it again. It also goes for the idea that you sort of need people to be morally debased if they're going to get the job done. And it kind of plays with that aspect as well. I think what reality has borne out now, particularly over the last decade or so, is that we really don't want morally debased police to sort things out. That's kind of the problem. And the morally debased cop is debased institutionally by a morally debased society, right? It's like they are the extension of, you know, the Trumpist world where, you know, black people are essentially disposable. You know, I think it's a very problematic world, to say the least. And I think True Detective, you know, Series 4 slightly skirts the issue by having two female cops in a part of the world which is so unlike kind of anywhere else that it feels a little bit alien to some of those conversations.
Yeah, I feel like it is sort of making excuses for their bad behaviour. The circumstances do excuse them because they are essentially in a place where the laws of both reality and man are breaking down, and there are occult forces that are much greater than them that they need to encounter and see off. So you would, in those circumstances, of course you might have to, you know, extrajudicially kill somebody and cover it up. But doesn't it that does feel like... Yeah, but that does feel like who are you kidding? That's not necessarily the world that we do live in, and I don't know that it interrogates that in a particularly intelligent way. And in Fargo, I suppose this season does have an entire sheriff's department which is wall to wall corrupt. another arm of a right wing militia that struts around and enforces its own laws with extreme brutality. But then there are these two crusading good cop characters. But then, you know, what happens to them? One of them is dispatched, seemingly for no particularly good reason, and the other one becomes the private enforcer of mega wealth. I'm not sure that's a satisfying conclusion for them either, or really what it says about policing.
Yeah, and the kind of rolling in of the, like, basically the entirety of the industrial military complex turn up at the end of Fargo to have a big gunfight with John Hamm. And that, I don't quite know why they do that and why it feels, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel about it, to be honest. It feels strange.
It's made it completely invisible, which is, I'm not sure that's a bad thing to do. I don't think I would have been satisfied had the I mean, I don't think I required the finale to end in like massive visualized bloodshed. But it is a surprising thing to omit that this massive battle happens and essentially we don't see any of it occur. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I'm unsure about that ending. I'm unsure what they're trying to say about it, what they're trying to say about the world we live in there. I'm with Dot. I'm on her tail. I'm following her story. But when it comes to the kind of conflict between, like, whatever the fuck the FBI are doing there and those kind of FBI characters who I liked, who were funny, cool characters, but, like, I don't know what the... You want some kind of pincer grip in that moment, right? You want something to... Everything kind of coming together and revealing something about each and every one of these kind of characters in there, and it just didn't. It just zeroed in on Rex and Dot, and that was fine because those are the ones I cared about, but I think... with those kind of overtly political, you know, sort of conversations that are taking place in the show, yeah, you kind of need to pay those off, I think, a little bit more than they did. So, like, a big gunfight would have done quite well for that. That would have been some kind of payoff.
Yeah. Instead, we sort of cut away to individual characters having their, you know, fates meted out to them. In ways which I also didn't find particularly compelling. I think my problem with both Fargo and the recent season of True Detective is that their metaphysical, philosophical aspirations sometimes feel quite hollow to me. I would say that's actually true of nearly all of Fargo and maybe all of the Coen brothers' work. I think we discussed this before on the podcast, but certainly, like, the Coen brothers' work, there is an obsession with the idea of fate in it. And while at the same time, fate is this sort of malevolent and very perverse and force, which is capable of delivering ironic punishments to people. The way that it is glossed is that, oh, it's, you know, it's just, oh, ooh, that's the universe for you. You know, you can't be angry at it. It's, in fact, the character in this says you can't be angry at fate. It's like being angry at a rock for being a rock. but that's, I don't think that's true, though. I don't think that's borne out because it's very obviously the writers themselves acting as perverse gods who, you know, manipulate people's destinies for whatever kind of dramatic effect they desire. And this is very true of the way that one of the crusading cops, Whit Farr, is extinguished at the end of the season. He faces John Hamm in a tunnel, and John Hamm correctly says, nope, this is not how my story ends. My destiny is the end of the tunnel, and there's literally nothing you can do now to stop me from getting to the end of the tunnel, even though he's got a gun pointed at him. And he's correct, because the writers just need to say John Hamm somehow gets around his gun and kills Whit Farr. And that's what happens. I find that very annoying, because there's no way that you can, the fiction can then bemoan fate at the same time as being the active creator of fate. Do you see what I mean? It's like the Coen brothers want to kind of raise their fist to the gods and say, you know, God damn, this is so unfair, whilst actually being the perpetrators of that unfairness.
Yeah, that is a deep thing in the Coen brothers' sort of take on the world. Sometimes I think it's actually pretty glorious. I think maybe my other favourite movie by them is... A Serious Man, which kind of glories in that stuff. And I think takes that stuff on really well.
Yes, I think it's because it's so discursive of that and so naked, yeah. You know, a self-mockery of that theme. But I absolutely love that film. That's one of my favourite films of all time.
it's so good. It's so good. I love Richard Kind is his brother making his, like, crazy, like, map of reality. That's fantastic. But, like, that is an aspect of the Coen brothers which sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. In the TV show Fargo, it is deployed in a slightly shaky form that sometimes feels like it makes sense when you're watching it and sometimes doesn't. There is this idea established in the first series of Fargo that Lorne Malvo is a kind of predator. He's this kind of, you know, this force of predation who's going to kind of, you know, track you down and murder you. And that is his sort of right in a kind of cosmic sense. And then that kind of comes up against this kind of force of goodness. And you have to kind of try and find a way. Those forces kind of meet and bump up in these kind of unusual ways. And that has this kind of knock-on effect. It's kind of a cosmic idea and also a kind of metaphysical idea. And it doesn't always... Sometimes it really feels like it works in the scene. Sometimes you, like, at the end of that series... you know, he says, I got, you know, the love interest say, I got to kill Lorne Malvo. Sorry, you didn't get to do it. And the Marge Gunderson character says, it's okay, I got to be police chief, you know. And she's kind of saying that, like, this is how it was supposed to kind of unfold. And, yeah, it almost feels like a kind of weird God of the Gaps type thing where you can sort of put it into anything that feels a little bit hazy. And suggest that it's a kind of about the violation or restoration of the sort of fundamental order of the universe, which again, like True Detective Series 1, very much trades in, right? Particularly in its final scene, entirely ripped off from Alan Moore's Top 10. really, we should read that. If you've read that page, I posted it on my Twitter the other day, they really did rip it off wholesale. But that kind of like, you know, Fault in the Stars type stuff, I think you have to be careful with, because it can end up, you know, just feeling like, oh, they just couldn't be bothered to work out the details here.
Well, it's a strange contrast with what a lot of the characters who perpetrate the greatest violence in these things purport to be their understanding of the universe. They are often nihilists, you know, and like the idea of being a nihilist in these obviously fated universes, it's like, you know, like having a rationalist society in Middle Earth. Like, what are you doing? It's like, no, don't believe in magic. Well, you fucking should, pal. It's all around you.
Oh, I'd love to.
And like, I find that kind of confusing. Especially as they use the nihilists as their little chess pieces to enact out their obvious agenda. Frustrated that there is not a more kind of a greater coherence to what is being said about the universe, I think. I'm not sure whether True Detective talks about fate in exactly the same context. I think it that final scene ripped off from Animal's Top 10 is more about how they couldn't ever possibly approach the larger forces that are at work here. They are, you know, rather than it being like Marge Gunderson's, oh, you know, I became chief of police, it's more that they got their guy. They got the one thing out of this that was possible for them, flawed humans, to actually do. And the larger machinations of the universe is just too big for them. And I think that's a lot of the way that the metaphysical and the supernatural works in True Detective. Like I said before, the idea of time itself, the idea that humans are rooted in linear time and thus unable to fully appreciate the extent of reality that other forces can appreciate and manipulate. That's sort of central, at least to the first and the third season, where it is the supernatural is this realm beyond that humans are unable to quite perceive and certainly not really affect. I feel like this later season of True Detective just absolutely has no interest in that at all. It's like, yep, ghosts are real. Definitely real. Yeah, 100% real. I'll throw an orange at you if you like. And then it will say things that echo things from the first season, like time is a flat circle. But there's absolutely no kind of follow through with that theme or an understanding of what that might have meant. It's not the supernatural in the first season is completely deniable. Like none of the stuff in that might be supernatural in True Detective season one has to be supernatural. Whereas in True Detective 4, like in the first episode, there are ghosts literally doing interpretive dance and you know, appearing behind people to affect jump scares. Like, but like, why would a ghost do that? Like, who benefits from a ghost being scary? I don't know. None of it makes any sense. And it feels just very reliant on unthinking horror movie jump scare cliche. Without any kind of overriding sense of what the supernatural or the metaphysical might mean. And that really is, even though I think True Detective, I probably shouldn't have any kind of nostalgia for it continuing some sort of theme from the first season, given how erratic the whole show has been since the first season, I still feel like that's a massive letdown, because that is the one thing from True Detective, like thematically, that I think is really worth pursuing and worth playing.
It was super cool. It was super cool that first series gestured towards the supernatural. That felt, you know, and to Robert Chambers and the King in Yellow and all that kind of esoteric stuff, without ever confirming it or doing anything with it really beyond evoking it as kind of part of the ideas behind the show. And I really appreciated that at the time. I remember the scene in the first series where you finally sort of meet the killer and see his home life. And he is a very frightening man, having sex with his sister, I seem to remember, and mouthing over the scenes of a movie he's watching on TV.
Doing a very good James Mason impression.
Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, I think so.
Fantastic. Really, really horrible and scary. And I think, you know, that I like the way that it uses madness to clarify those themes, right? It uses the very real feeling, craziness of that guy to kind of... There's a thing in Alan Moore where he talks about, and I'm sure it's in From Hell, and it's the thing that Alan Moore says turned him into a wizard at the age of 40, which is where the guy says that the only place where all of the gods and monsters and demons in our world absolutely exist is inside our own imagination, right? He's like that's the one place where they undeniably take form. And I think, yeah, True Detective does a good job of kind of making that feel like a real notion within this world. Whereas like True Detective Night Country just takes place in a world where ghosts definitely exist. Everyone sees them. Ghosts are real. It's fine. And that just feels a little bit less robust, weirdly enough.
Well, I also think it completely explodes the mystery. I mean, these are detective stories, at least nominally. And in the first season of True Detective, like there is the crime that is being investigated is a completely human crime, end to end. Like, its motives may have been supernatural, but it's not perpetrated by monsters. And so it has a human solution, which is possible to work out, as the detectives do. And the Night Country doesn't. Like, it sets out this thing where it immediately says, oh, yeah, these men, they couldn't possibly have died by any normal, explicable means. Look how horrific it is. It's like literally something out of the film The Thing. These men have clawed their own eyes out, and all these other bits of evidence which suggest it couldn't possibly have been a normal death that occurred here. And at the same time, it's constantly showing you literal ghosts and mysterious bears and all these other kinds of spooky things that don't actually have any meaning ultimately, saying, oh, could it have been ghosts? Could it have been ghosts all this time? Could it have been ghosts? Oh, yeah. The ghosts are throwing oranges at people and leading them astray and all this other stuff. And at the end, it isn't ghosts. It has a human... It has part of it. It just decides, oh no, actually, what we said earlier was completely not true. The men did have a completely explicable, normal means of death, which somehow forensically has no evidence attached to it. And then any remaining questions you might have. Oh, that was probably ghosts. But, you know, questions, some questions don't have answers. And that just feels like, oh, that's the compromise between the supernatural and the human worlds that is the least satisfying you could have possibly landed on.
I don't know if you've seen the show Evil. I might have talked to you before on a previous lock-in.
I haven't, actually. No.
It's very, very good. And it's about I think she's a behavioralist or a behavioral psychologist and a priest and a tech nerd guy teaming up to investigate sort of religious crimes, like people being possessed. Demonic possession is most of it. He's like an exorcist in training. And it's by the team behind The Good Wife and The Good Lawyer. So it's that writing team. It's really fucking good, that show. It's really robust. It kind of takes a sort of X-Files-y premise. And the super clever thing they do is in every single episode of that show, there is a supernatural explanation for what's happened and a rationalist explanation for what happened. And they never come down on either side. And it works, right? It works really, really well for that. They always have two different explanations or more explanations for whatever the crime is at the center of the episode. It's a story of the week type show. And it's never unsatisfying because it feels like it feels sexy and uncertain, right? And I think in True Detective, you know, there would be a version of this where they pull that off that might have been more believable. You know, where there is a kind of, and I think they're gesturing towards that. I think that's what they want to do, but what they end up doing is basically doing both, right? Saying this is both a supernatural event and a very real event based on very real things. And yeah, that just feels, it just confuses and skews everything to such an extent that the series kind of falls apart in that final episode, I think.
Yeah, I don't know why it needed to be both. The supernatural doesn't operate in any particularly interesting way in this or expound any greater meaning or purpose. It just seems to be there as a distraction.
Yeah, and I think about how Fargo has deployed supernatural moments just as a kind of, I think it's done it brilliantly. So the ones I can think of is in the very first episode, Lorne Malvo impossibly escapes from Martin Freeman's basement in the opening episode. There's no way for him to get out of there, and somehow he manages to disappear. It's this one little bit of impossible magic he does in the whole series, and it just makes him so terrifying because you just don't quite know what you're getting with him, you know, and it sort of introduces the supernatural. Never returns to it, I don't think. But that makes it really good. There's a moment in the second series where a UFO descends from on high. Yeah. And Kristen Stewart just says, Jesse Plemons says, "What the hell is that?" And she goes, "UFO, hun," which is pretty good. I can't remember if there was one in series three. In series four, there's a very good moment involving a hurricane, which is in the kind of bottle episode. And then actually in series five of Fargo, I thought this brings around to one of the more successful episodes, actually. I thought the episode with the Lindas, which was about Dot, kind of what it turned out to be, dreaming an encounter with this kind of women's refuge, where these women have been abused, and which was being run by the woman who kind of fed her to Rex. I love that episode. I thought it was brilliant. She had to build a puppet in order to sort of explicate her trauma.
That was the least credible thing in the entire season. Her the speed with which she constructed a puppet.
Well, she
done some whittling, and that
she was dreaming though. Yeah,
I know.
It was a dream.
So when you say you liked that episode, did you like the fact it was a dream, or did you like the content of that dream?
I liked how hard it went. I liked how it sort of headed for the danger of the story. It sort of found a way to really burrow into the history of this person and her feelings towards, you know, the original Linda. And I don't know, there's something about the confidence and with which it portrayed something that felt plausibly dreamlike. You know, the idea of you have to build a doll in order to tell your story. I mean, possibly...
How quickly did you clock that it was a dream? And was that satisfying?
Oh, immediately. I mean, I knew... I could tell it was a dream immediately, yeah. Because she was doing a whole bunch of falling asleep in cafes and stuff like that. It didn't bother me because it was a fun place to spend time. That's the funny thing about it. That was a fun place to hang out with unusual characters. And it was her kind of disappearing into a little pocket dimension to unwind some personal stuff, which can often be a shortcut in a story, right? Just a character coming to a realization in a dream. But I think it was done with care and, to be honest, much more care than you'd expect a male writer to give such a sensitive topic. Perhaps I am just showing my own very male ignorance here of such things, but I thought the way it portrayed domestic abuse and the way that it kind of, the insidious ways in which it hurts people rather than just the obvious ones. I found that very powerful and truthful, I guess is what I think.
I liked the content of the dream, but I didn't necessarily like the fact it was a dream sequence I find that a sort of slightly tiring device in any form of fiction, as it divorces you from the consequence of what's generally happening, because obviously it's not happening. I find my foot tapping, just like, get back to reality so we can proceed. But you're right that a lot of the things it is discursive of is Fargo at its most articulate about the plight of women who are subject to violence.
Yeah, and I think that's something Trudick for very much has in common, right? I think when it lets its female characters speak and speak about what's been done to them and speak about their experiences and their their truth. As the younger millennials among our listenership might say, that is when I'm most engaged with the show. I think that's when it feels most real to me, and I think the kind of the physicalization of that across the series is the less successful element.
I mean, Fargo is quite playful with its these sorts of things. It is willing to do these sorts of puppets and dream sequences and so forth. I wonder if True Detective would have benefited from being more experimental, whether it was originally written to use that same flashback device, the same interrogation framing device that the first season does. Because there is an interrogation at the end of the season of True Detective where Liz Danvers is narrating dishonestly what has occurred. I wonder if it was at any point structured to use that as the framing device, but then was abandoned and then rewritten to be linear. Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me because it has that built into it. It has a murder that's happened several years ago that's caused these partners to split off from each other and then they come back together. They just tell that all in the present moment. And yeah, quite possibly it would have been more interesting if they'd split it up like they did in series one, definitely.
Do you like the cast in general in these shows?
Oh my goodness. The cast of both shows, just fantastic across the board, to be honest. I can't really think of a weak link in there. I mean, I think in Fargo, I think Juno Temple, who's an actress I've sort of seen in stuff for years now, I'm very, very surprised by how brilliant she was, how she carried the whole series, really. An amazing performance, very good American accent, just wonderful. I was also John Hamm. I think you were slightly less convinced by him, but I thought it's the best he's been since Mad Men. I actually found him genuinely intimidating and frightening, and I think he did a good job of kind of turning his character from, the guy who stands up and he's got his nipples pierced in his like crazy outdoor hot tub, which I definitely want, by the way, and then actually turning him into a deeply horrible, character who's frightening. I thought that was a good trick that he mostly pulled off all by himself. And I also liked the dude from the viral video on Zoom a couple of years ago, who was that guy who was auditioning for that British director who was going, oh, look at his awful house. Remember that?
And he played what's this?
Don't you remember this? It was an audition that the actor himself ended up posting online, sort of saying, I did my best, where the director, who was Tristan Shapiro, the British director, had he thought his mic was muted, and he said to him, "Oh God, look at this poor TV on the wall." Right? He was sort of,
"Oh God,
do you remember that?" And then the guy was like, "The guy heard it, and he was like, hey man, I'm trying. I'm just trying to do my thing." And then the director was like, "Oh, the director came out later and sort of said, no, I was expressing sympathy." Like, no, you fucking weren't. Anyway, that
so
guy.
Who of these people? Which one of the guys?
He's the golf guy. The golf guy.
Oh,
that guy.
Oh, shit. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Now I do remember that.
Yeah. He was also seen doing a bit of rimming in the first series of The White Lotus. So I thought he was great as well. His I Want a Wife speech, really, really good. Dave Foley as the kind of fixer guy with an eye patch. as well.
Yeah, I thought they were all fantastic. My only hesitation about Ham is that maybe I probably would have gone with somebody who sort of reeked more of hypocrisy and sanctimony, whereas on the surface he seems quite affable and normal. But maybe that's just me being very unsubtle. I also thought... I forget the name. Oh, Joe Keery, formerly of Stranger Things, is absolutely great as John Hamm's son, Gator. Just this absolute men's rights activist-pilled asshole who, you know, puts on a pair of wraparound shades and immediately thinks he's a member of SEAL Team 6. It's another example, you know, like the way that Fargo looks at different aspects of the right and finds different exemplars of all these different factions within it.
Of all the all the side characters, he was of the sort of more minor side characters in that show. I thought he was good. I loved the exchange where Gina Temple tells him that she's seen his mother, and then he asks her later on if that was true, and she's like, "No, it was just a dream." I thought that was very good, very moving. And of course, the dude playing Una Munk. Yeah. Whoever that is. Sam Spruill?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not wholly familiar with him in other things, I have to say, but he's wearing a leather kilt.
A leather kilt. There's that bit where he just turns up at that woman's house and says, like, "I live here now." That's pretty good. And then murders her son.
Yeah.
That was good.
I'd like to say something about the music in this, which... The selection of music, I find in both, although less so in Fargo, where it does do interesting things with its soundtrack, I find that increasingly the shows of this sort of prestige now come with such overt, please listen to my demo tape, sequence of songs that I find it very distracting and distancing. And a lot of the time it's very literal. I mean, you know, toxic to soundtrack, John Hamm's toxic male character, a little on the nose. I preferred it when it was YMCA soundtracking the assemblage of the militia. That at least is kind of ironic and funny. But then True Detective, there's a lot of stuff where the track seems to have been selected because some of the lyrics literally describe the verbs that are occurring on the scene. And I just don't know why this happens. It's so annoying.
It's
like there's
annoying.
There's a character and they are having sex and they come and there's the soundtrack is, you know, the word coming lingers over the moment of ejaculation. I want to throw, you know, the TV out the window when that kind of stuff happens.
I was too very surprised to hear the lightning scenes featuring David Baddiel and Frank Skinner in True Detective.
Oh, if only. Actually, the most egregious example of this that I've seen recently is in the TV show Reacher, where in the second season has just been and gone. And
Reacher, S Club 7, reach for the stars.
I mean, it's not far off that level of crassness in that Reacher has to... It's a scene in which all Reacher does is walk in slow motion through a gate, which is manned by enemy guards. And it plays Super Bon Bon by Soul Coughing, in which the lyrics are, "Move aside and let the man go through." And like, yes, that is what is happening on screen. Thank you. Yes. It's like the music editor has just popped up and he's like, "All right, yeah, I'm the music editor. And I just thought I'd let you know about some subtext that you might have missed. You see, Reacher is walking through a gate. And what I've done is I've played some music And the lyrics say he's walking through a gate, so the two match each other. Anyway, enjoy the movie, won't you? Ta-da! And then I just like, no fiction can continue from that point without it being tarnished.
Well, first of all, that guy needs his own show. yeah, and Into Dust by Mazzy Star, which has now been in 100% of all programs ever. it's a great song, which does fit really well if you put it over a montage of stuff being picked up. Like, ooh, what's this guy doing now? What's this guy doing? What's she doing now? But it has been fucking used to death, and they need to stop putting it on HBO prestige dramas, because, like, enough. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about the final scene of Fargo Series 5?
I absolutely loved that. That brought it all back for me and completely sold it to me, in that it is a repudiation of some of the things that I have problems with, talking about nihilism and fate and all these sorts of things. And you have this the character of Ola Munk, very much in the similar sort of situation that Chigurh finds himself in with, I forget her name, the character.
It's Kelly MacDonald's character, yeah.
Kelly MacDonald's wonderful character in No Country for Old Men. And yet, the persistence with which Ola Munk's nihilist philosophy is dismantled by Minnesota Nice. It's not only very funny, but it is a sort of destruction of that idea that fate is cruel and inevitable and it's coming for you and you can't bemoan fate. And actually, you can completely disarm fate. And actually, maybe all Kelly MacDonald needed to do was make some pancakes for Chigurh and it would have been fine.
Yeah, it's a really remarkable scene. I think I read an interview where he says it's directly referencing that sequence. And it's interesting because they all have to keep persisting with it, right? The conversation has to keep going. They have to keep changing the activity, right? Let's go and make the Bisquick and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And let's keep countering what he's saying best we can with our positivist attitude to the world, which eventually pays off when he eats some Bisquick and smiles. and I guess, you know, that did sort of hit on something pretty true feeling to me, actually, in that we do live in these insanely divided times, particularly in America, but also everywhere, right? Where conversation between people across divides has just entirely broken down. And you know, this ending scene, like, really pushing very hard at the notion that all you can do is be nice to each other and maybe you can break these cycles, you know. And he keeps kind of jumping in with his yes, going like, a man has a code, the code must be put, you know, and her kind of going, yeah, but sure, does it though, and all that sort of stuff. And I think that, yeah, it just felt very clever. None of the unkillable forces of evil in Fargo have ever been disarmed, and it feels kind of revolutionary after several series and a movie of that never happening for it to suddenly happen at the end of this show. And there's a really great moment in that sequence where he hands him an orange soda or whatever and then clinks the bottle, and the bottle comes off in from off screen to just think to cheers him, and that's the kind of moment you sort of know it's going to be okay. Very good. Yeah.
Where do you think these shows can and should go next?
Well, Hawley's doing his Alien TV show next, which should be pretty damn good, I think. Alien is one of those franchises which is almost always terrible, right? But when it's good, there's nothing quite like it. So I'm sort of looking forward to that. I also genuinely think Legion Series 2 is his kind of masterpiece that I'm kind of constantly thinking about. I think it'd be interesting how he kind of goes with the times. Like, I don't know how this election in America is going to go. I mean, as John Stewart was very eloquently pointing out the other night, whichever way it goes, there's still huge problems to solve, which I thought was very true. So I'm not sure. I feel like he's done a lot with Fargo, and I think actually I wouldn't be so bothered if he left it here, because he's such a brilliant creator that, like, I think maybe he needs to let the world change a bit more and settle down a bit before he comes back in, because it has become a kind of weirdly state of the nation kind of vibe. And when he hit that too hard in the previous series, it kind of felt weird and wrong. Whereas here, it feels kind of deft and clever for the most part.
Yeah. What would you do with a future season of True Detective? Do you think there is mileage in that brand now? Has its supernatural become so overt that it needs to pursue that in a more overt form in future installments?
Well, what I would say is that Issa Lopez is going to do the next series, and I think that's brilliant news, because despite all my misgivings about the series, it's incredibly well made. We didn't talk about the performances in True Detective, but it's incredibly well made. It's incredibly well performed, again, across the board. The sense of place, the tone, the kind of sense of, you know, this location just can't be overstated. It's incredibly, incredible feeling show, I think. Incredibly immersive. And the script writing moment to moment was just very good. There's nothing wrong with
all the characters and their relationships.
There's nothing wrong with it at all until you get to the kind of central idea behind it, which is a little bit, is well-intentioned but flawed. And I think, you know, she is clearly some kind of genius with how like beautiful and earthy and real and vivid the show feels and how well it's written. So like, I think whatever she does next with it is probably going to be, my prediction is it'll be pretty special. Actually, I think if they can sort of learn from a couple of the slight missteps here, I think whatever they do next is going to be fascinating, to be honest.
I agree. I look forward to season 6.
And Nick Pozzolito slagging it off on his Instagram is just...
Oh, was he?
Oh, yeah, he's been doing it. He said, what did he say? Some of the sloppiest writing I've ever watched. He's being absolutely awful. He's been posting criticism of the show on his Instagram. He said... The writing, he's sharing things from other writers on Instagram. I say writers, I mean idiots. Saying things like, some of the sloppiest TV I've ever seen. The show in general was a hot mess of faux character arcs, which made repeated heavy-handed attempts to show that quote-unquote man problem. Man equals problem. That's what he's been posting on his social media recently.
Jeez. That's wrong also.
it's wrong, and he is like... He is being a prize prick about it, and it does just seem like, I said this on Twitter, he just seems to hold people in contempt. He just holds the whole thing in contempt. I think he might hold women in contempt. I'm not sure, but like, he is behaving very, very badly.
I mean, I can imagine he's upset that he's had a franchise he had a hand in birthing, having had that taken off him, but... you'd think the creator of season 2 of True Detective might show a little bit more humility.
Also, people have got real problems in the world. It's like, have some perspective, mate. Like, someone did a weird thing with the show that you... What the fuck is wrong with you? Like, you know, people die horribly. You know, people lose their jobs. You can't sit here and moan about this. You know, it's just so undignified. And actually, the creators of that show, Evil, I mentioned before, were tweeting about it, just sort of saying, I think they just said brutally, this is not a good look for a showrunner.
Anyway, I'd, for all the dissatisfaction I found in the way it constructed its supernatural and how that affected the central mystery, I found it an extraordinarily compelling character drama, and I would have happily watched a show about those characters without any of the mystery or the supernatural. I'd just watch a slice of life drama about Liz Danvers and Evangeline Navarro. I thought they were extraordinary and beautifully drawn characters. And I want to see Callie Reyes in I don't know, is it Race? Rice? I don't know.
Yeah, no idea. She's great, isn't she?
Absolutely fantastic. And it's really nice to see actors who have like such a powerful physical presence as well.
Yeah, very good. That there's an early sex scene, isn't there, where she just fucking takes control. It's quite it's quite a thing to behold. And she's just like, just both of them, actually. And another, pouring a bit more sugar on that show, like both of them play complicated characters, complicated and complex, which is kind of rare in this day and age. They really do both contain multitudes, and that
I think that is the heritage of True Detective. I think that is one of the ways in which it is a loyal continuation of the series, is that those characters are as intelligent and conflicted and flawed as the two detectives in the first season. And I think it doesn't let them get away with that either, in perhaps the way that the first season does.
Yes, I think that's right.
Although I'm not quite convinced that the fate that it meets out to Angelina Navarro, which just seemed, she will wander the world now, perhaps as a ghost, perhaps not. I don't know. I don't know what that meant or whether what to feel about it, really.
No, me neither.
Well, should we leave it there?
Let's leave it there.
Let's leave it there. All these recordings are uploaded as videos to YouTube. You can find other stuff by us there. The address for that is youtube.com/CrateAndCrowbar. Thanks, as always, to our backers on Patreon. They aren't charged for these lock-in episodes, only the regular gaming episodes, but you can back us too at patreon.com/CrateAndCrowbar, or you can join our Discord community, the link for which is on our website, CrateAndCrowbar.com. That's it. I've been a ghost, and I'm now going to throw an orange at somebody.
I'm that meme of Matthew McConaughey smoking while staring at a phone screen with his bug eyes.